Good evening for WBAI News in New York. I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, January 18, 2017. In reaction to President Barack Obama granting clemency to Puerto Rican national Oscar Lopez Rivera, New York City Councilmember Melissa Mark Vividito says it was very, very emotional.
I cried when I got notice, and we were notified slightly before it was made public by the president and the White House. And, you know, I've been personally invested, as many know, of this issue. I wanted to raise awareness of of Oscar Lopez Rivera, who he is, and the number of years he has been imprisoned. Through the advocacy that I've provided, I want to thank my colleagues in this council who voted on a resolution to support his release. So the Black Latino Asian Caucus, to the Jewish Caucus, this campaign has broad-based international support. Pope Francis had expressed his support. Nobel Peace laureates had exhorted the president as their peer, someone else who was also a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, to grant clemency and pardon. So it's an incredible day for me, but also for obviously the Puerto Rican people, for his daughter, for his family, who will be able to embrace him as a free man. And so it just means a lot for us, and I think particularly at this time, when Puerto Rico is going through a very difficult challenge and economic, some sort of a morale boost was very important to us, and this has brought a lot of joy to many people.
The speaker was asked about any relationship which Lopez may have had to the bombings in the 70s and 80s, but he was not linked to any of those attacks.
He's not accused of having inflicted any harm, and he is not directly linked to any act of violence. He has clearly expressed that he does not support violence, and he embraces peace. And that is why, for him, Pope Francis was an inspirational figure. He painted a portrait of Pope Francis, which I had the ability to give to the Pope personally. 35 years, I think the gesture that the president has taken demonstrates reconciliation. And it is a gesture in terms of what we represent as a country as well, as what we should be. It was a disproportionate length of time that he has served, again, purely for his political beliefs. And he is the last remaining Puerto Rican prisoner, and we want him home. And we're glad that we'll be able to see him home.
Will you continue to struggle to get him a full pardon?
He's coming out. He's unconditional release once he comes out. He's going to be coming home. He has not been accused, as I've indicated, of any act of violence, and that needs to be clear. I think there's a lot of misinformation and mischaracterization of who he is and why he is in jail. And 35 years, again, at 74 years of age, for not having committed any act of violence is clearly disproportionate and unjust.
He got out of jail.
Yes, he did. He was offered a pardon and a release by President Clinton. He did not. He is a Vietnam veteran. He is a Bronze Star recipient. He did not believe in leaving his colleagues behind, because that offer that President Clinton offered him was not offered to all. And that's the sole reason he decided to stay. And now everyone has been released, and he is the last remaining prisoner. So we've been anxiously awaiting this action, and we're really happy that President Obama, very grateful to President Obama for doing this on his way out.
Before we switch up here, can you reiterate that a little bit in Spanish? So
yeah.
Yes, just a little bit. Not all of it, but a little bit.
Esto es sumamente importante para nosotros. Es una campaña que se ha desarrollado a través de los años, no solamente de puertorriqueños clamando por la excarcelación de Oscar, sino también solidaridad internacional. Y eso es importante, que esto es más allá de solamente la comunidad puertorriqueña, pero claro, para nosotros en este momento de sumo reto, donde tenemos una crisis económica, donde tenemos una junta de control fiscal antidemocrática, yo creo que este gesto de parte del presidente al salir es un mensaje de reconciliación, y le damos las gracias al presidente por esa valentía que ha demostrado en dejar a Oscar regresar a su patria y a su familia.
New York City Speaker Melissa Mark Vividito on the release of Puerto Rican national Oscar Lopez Rivera, who was not convicted of any act of violence, but who was imprisoned based on his political beliefs. And this is the news on WBAI in New York. We didn't chew the fat, that's what New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said after he met with Donald Trump at Trump Tower in Manhattan on Fifth Avenue today. He said they spoke about how devastating it would be for New Yorkers and those in other states to not be able to deduct state and local taxes, and how it would affect more than 3 million New York families if the Affordable Care Act were repealed. And Cuomo said he spoke with Trump about how the federal government could play a large role in improvements in infrastructure the governor wants to get done.
We are ready to go in New York. We are ready to build. If he wants to put federal money to use and put federal money to use quickly, this is the state to do it. Many of the big projects that I want to get done involve federal interaction. Improving LaGuardia Airport, that's federal interaction. Improving JFK Airport, the subway system that needs dramatic improvement, that involves the federal government.
Also today, President Barack Obama gave his final news conference as president. He said there are issues, like with Dreamers, where he will continue to speak out.
There's a difference between that normal functioning of politics and certain issues or certain moments where I think our core values may be at stake. I put in that category if I saw systematic discrimination being ratified in some fashion. I put in that category explicit or functional obstacles to people being able to vote, to exercise their franchise. I'd put in that category institutional efforts to silence dissent or the press. And for me, at least, I would put in that category efforts to round up kids who have grown up here and for all practical purposes are American kids and send them someplace else when they love this country. They are our kids' friends and their classmates and are now entering into community colleges or, in some cases, serving in our military. The notion that we would just arbitrarily or because of politics punish those kids when they didn't do anything wrong themselves, I think would be something that would merit me speaking out.
And Obama defended his administration's rapprochement with Cuba and his 11th-hour move to end the wet-foot, dry-foot policy that lets any Cuban who makes it to U.S. soil stay and become a legal resident.
My view was, after 50 years of a policy not working, it made sense for us to try to reopen diplomatic relations, to engage a Cuban government, to be honest with them about the strong disagreements we have around political repression and treatment of dissenters and freedom of press and freedom of religion, but that to make progress for the Cuban people, our best shot was to suddenly have the Cuban people interacting with Americans and seeing the incredible success of the Cuban American community and engaging in commerce and business and trade, and that it was through that process of opening up these bilateral relations that you would see over time serious and significant improvement. Given that that shift in the relationship, the policy that we had in place with wet foot, dry foot, which treated Cuban emigres completely different from folks from El Salvador or Guatemala or Nicaragua or any other part of the world, one that made a distinction between whether you got here by land or by foot, that was a carryover of a old way of thinking that didn't make sense in this day and age, particularly as we're opening up travel between the two countries. We had very lengthy consultations with the Department of Homeland Security. We had some tough negotiations with the Cuban government. But we arrived at a policy which we think is both fair and appropriate to the changing nature of the relationship between the two countries.
Obama says he continues to be worried about Israeli-Palestinian issues, that his administration tried to preserve the possibility of a two-state solution. He stood behind his decision to allow a UN Security Council resolution to pass criticizing Israel over the settlements, though he conceded Trump might pursue a different approach.
In light of shifts in Israeli politics and Palestinian politics, a rightward drift in Israeli politics, a weakening of President Abbas's ability to move and take risks on behalf of peace in the Palestinian territories, in light of all the dangers that have emerged in the region, and the understandable fears that Israelis may have about the chaos and rise of groups like ISIL and the deterioration of Syria. In light of all those things, what we at least wanted to do, understanding that the two parties wouldn't actually arrive at a final status agreement, is to preserve the possibility of a two-state solution because we do not see an alternative to it.
President Barack Obama in his final news conference as president. And this is the news on WBAI in New York.
The campaign begins again at the break of day. $1 million loan, nobody makes it on their own. Without $1 million loan, to cast the first stone.
As time marches forward towards Trump's inauguration, Republicans rush to push through Trump's nominations. Today, there were hearings for Wilbur Ross as Commerce Secretary. His wealth is estimated at $2.9 billion off the backs of the poor, the housing crisis, and through distressed companies he navigated through bankruptcy, which he repackaged and sold for profit. Another hearing is for Scott Pruitt for the EPA. Environmentalists say he is just a horrible, horrible choice. There's a hearing for Georgia Representative Tom Price for health secretary. He may have used his position to help a company he bought stock in. Price has been pushing to repeal the Affordable Care Act for years. And then there's Betsy DeVos for education secretary. Her hearing took place last night. Senator Patty Murray is Labor and Pensions Committee ranking member. She's a mom, a former preschool teacher and school board member who attended public schools with her six brothers and sisters. She says this was possible with robust federal support, and she raises important questions and concerns about the DeVos nomination, beginning with possible conflicts of interest for the billionaire nominee.
So, Ms. DeVos, I am looking forward to hearing your answers to some questions, since I have a number of very serious concerns that need to be addressed. First, I'm going to want to learn more about your extensive financial entanglements and potential conflicts of interest. As a billionaire with hundreds, if not thousands, of investments made through complex financial instruments, many of which are made in ways that are not transparent and very hard to track, you need to make it very clear how you will be avoiding conflicts of interest should you be confirmed. That goes for your investments as well as the massive web of investments made by your immediate family. Despite starting off on the wrong track by not having an ethics letter complete before this hearing today, I appreciate what you are doing to provide this committee the information to understand how you intend to live up to the highest level of ethics and transparency. So far, you have not accepted calls to release 3 years of tax returns, but I'm hoping you reconsider that approach and that you are cooperating fully with the Office of Government Ethics. Second, I have major concerns with how you spent your career and fortune fighting to privatize public education and gut investments in public schools. I'll have some specific questions about how the privatization policies you have pushed have impacted students and how you intend to use the public trust and taxpayer dollars to support public education and not continue to undermine schools and teachers from inside the department as you have as an advocate from the outside. I will want to know more about the large contributions you've made to groups that are ideologically opposed to workers, including teachers, and that want to impose anti-LGBT or anti-women's health beliefs on public schools and the students in them. I will want to make sure you publicly commit to implementing our Every Student Succeeds Act by upholding the strong federal guardrails that are in that law. And I will want to know how you plan to tackle the persistent achievement gap. Third, while you have been outspoken on K-12 issues, your record and positions are not clear in a number of critical areas. So I want to learn more about how you plan to approach higher education and whether or not we can count on you to stand with students and borrowers. I'm very interested in your thoughts on Title IX and how we can do everything possible to stop the scourge of campus sexual assault. I was not happy with how you talked about this issue when we met. I'm hopeful that you have learned more about it since then and are prepared to address it seriously. I'm going to want to know how your personal religious and ideological views on women's health and safety would impact how you'd approach this issue in the department. And I'm very concerned with what has been reported in the press about your views on the importance of the Office of Civil Rights, which works to ensure students with disabilities, LGBTQ students, religious minorities, women and girls, students of color, and all of our students are treated with dignity and respect. And I'm going to want to know more about how you will enforce critical civil rights laws. And as all of my colleagues here know, I have a particular passion for early learning. And I want to hear where you stand and how the federal government can help ensure that every child is prepared for success in kindergarten. Those are just a few of the issues, so I am looking forward to a robust dialogue tonight. I'm hoping you're transparent about your views, open about your record and the impact it has had on students, and willing to make some straightforward commitments regarding the core responsibilities of this department and the role you hope to take in it.
The billionaire was evasive in answering questions before the Senate Health and Education Committee. By 6 p.m. last night, Senator Patty Murray expressed outrage that no second round of questioning of DeVos was being permitted by the chair of the Health and Education Committee, Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander. Then Senator Murray gets a last question to DeVos.
Mrs. DeVos, President-elect Trump was recorded bragging about kissing and groping and trying to have sex with women without their consent. He said on tape that when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. I was and I remain very outraged by those comments. And that outrage grew following the release of that recording as a series of women came forward to publicly accuse President-elect Trump of exactly the type of behavior he bragged about on that tape. I take accusations of this type of behavior very seriously. If this behavior, kissing and touching women and girls without their consent, happened in a school, would you consider it a sexual assault?
Yes.
1 in 5 young women will experience sexual assault while in college. We are joined tonight by several sexual assault survivors who are brave enough to come here tonight because this issue is so important to them. Can you promise them and me that you will not, as has been in the press, consider, quote, reining in the Office for Civil Rights and the department's work to protect students from campus sexual assault?
Senator, if confirmed, I commit that I will be looking very closely at how this has been regulated and handled, and with great sensitivity to those who are victims, and also considering perpetrators as well. But please know that I am very sensitive to this.
I have heard you say that, but you will not take back the words that you will rein in the Office for Civil Rights.
I don't believe those were the words that I used.
Well, that is a quote that's been attributed to you. We've spent, I thank Senator Casey on this as well. This is extremely important to women and men across the country, and I hope that you will take back the words of reigning in the Office of Civil Rights and the department's work on sexual assault. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn to Senator Hassan for the last part of my questions.
Thank you, Senator Murray.
Senator Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire.
Just two quick things, Ms. DeVos. I just wanted to clarify the issue about whether you were on the board of your mother's foundation. I have 990s up through 2013 where you're listed as the vice president and a board member. So was that just a mistake on your part?
That was a clerical error. I can assure you I have never made decisions on my mother's behalf on her foundation board.
So the listing that you were the vice president of the board is incorrect?
That is incorrect.
Okay, thank you. The other thing I just wanted to circle back to, I want to go back to the Individual with Disabilities and Education Act. That's a federal civil rights law. So do you stand by your statement a few minutes ago that it should be up to the states whether to follow it?
The law must be followed. Federal law must be followed where federal dollars are in play.
So were you unaware what I just asked you about the IDEA, that it was a federal law?
I may have confused it.
It guarantees absolutely basic protections to students with disabilities to ensure that they are afforded a high-quality education with their peers. One of the reasons that it is difficult to have this hearing and feel that we fully understand your perspective is because we do know that children with disabilities in at least some of the voucher programs that you have supported have gone with a voucher to a school because of their disability, had to leave the school. The school keeps the money, and they go back to public schools that now have even less resources to deal with them. And many of us see this as the potential for turning our public schools into warehouses for the most challenging kids with disabilities or other kinds of particular issues, or the kids whose parents can't afford to make up the difference between the voucher and the cost of private school tuition. So I just would urge you to become familiar, should you be nominated, with the Individual with Disabilities and Education Act. And I do have to say I'm concerned that you seem so unfamiliar with it and that you seem to support voucher schools that have not honored, you know, have made students sign away their rights to make sure that the law is enforced. That's very troubling to me.
Senator, I assure you that if confirmed, I will be very sensitive to the needs of special needs students and the policies surrounding that.
And with all due respect, it's not about sensitivity, although that helps. It's about being willing to enforce the law to make sure that my child and every child has the same access to public education, high-quality public education. And the reality is that the way the voucher systems that you have supported work don't always come out that way. And that's why it's something we need to continue to explore. Thank you.
Certainly.
Thank you, Senator Hassan. Senator Murray.
Patrick Walsh is a public school teacher in Harlem, and he's a chapter leader for the United Federation of Teachers. He's also a writer and a musician and one who believes passionately in democracy and the common good. Here's his essay prompted by the DeVos nomination.
Thoughts occasioned by Donald Trump, Betsy DeVos, and a doorknob. Little things are big things, said a rhetoric professor I was fortunate enough to have studied under. The words have stayed with me, welling up in my head from time to time, always somehow bearing out their wisdom. One such occasion took place recently when, attending a meeting in a school other than my own, I reached down to open a door, and there in my hand was a doorknob bearing the words, Public School, City of New York, surrounded by filigree. I was for a moment taken aback. It seemed so terribly out of place, outside of the psychological climate in which my teacher colleagues and I have labored for years. And this is why. Someone, somewhere, took time to make this doorknob, and that someone took pride in both the work and the public school system. I have no idea of the exact provenance of that doorknob, but I know it came from a time in which New York City and the rest of America believed in public works, public servants, public institutions, and the public good. That is to say, we believed in a social contract that was not beholden to market forces or Wall Street speculators or the whims of billionaires who have been allowed, when not encouraged, to dictate public policy. We believed, that is, in the wake of the immense suffering of the Great Depression, and because of the bloody struggle of the union movement, that human life had inherent dignity and people had common rights and that it was the duty of the government, as the only institution that could guarantee them, to do so. One such right was the right to a decent education. We believe, too, even if it was never explicitly stated, that we had the civic, moral, and yes, spiritual responsibility to look after each other. We had an understanding that we were here to help each other through the messy, difficult, sublime thing called life, hence the creation of Social Security. Such public institutions served America, however imperfectly, for decades and created the greatest shared prosperity, even if one not shared by all, in human history. A vital component in that unprecedented human as well as economic success was the public school system. After 15 years of ceaseless, insidious assault by the richest people in America, greased by bipartisan attacks from state houses coast to coast, codified by the policies of Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and aided by the most well-financed and sustained public relations campaign against the legal profession in American history, it is more and more difficult to remember the vital place of the public school system, never mind believe in it. Propaganda and perception management, relentlessly and brilliantly implemented, work. The sight of that old doorknob struck me as especially poignant and haunting in light of our own hour, not only one of complete corporate hegemony and ceaseless undermining of the social contract, but one suddenly led by a mentally unstable political novice, determined to fill his cabinet with persons who seek to destroy the very institutions they are entrusted with. Public institutions, mind you, that, if Trump gets his way, will be given over exclusively to private ends. In the process, they seek to finish off, once and for all, the anemic remnants of public life in America, beginning with the public school system. The destruction of the public school system is unquestionably the mission of Betsy DeVos, Trump's preposterous selection for Secretary of Education. Yes, even more preposterous than Arne Duncan. It may well happen. If the election of the man-child Trump proves nothing else, it proves that in today's America, anything, no matter how reckless, insane, or suicidal, is quite possible. It may well come to pass that in a few years' time, that doorknob will be seen as an artifact of an institution gone the way of the Tyrannosaurus, replaced by God only knows what, but you can rest assured that some corporations will be making billions from it, and education will be further reduced to some kind of degrading job training. Little things are big things, and we will need both small acts and mass movements to thwart the catastrophe that is surely upon us. Weeks after the election of Trump, it grows clearer and clearer that we, as a nation and as a people, are heading into unprecedented darkness, a new and horrific chapter in the American experience. We will either create new forms of resistance and new forms of representation, or we will, too, be degraded soon enough into silence.
Patrick Walsh, public school teacher in Harlem, chapter leader in the United Federation of Teachers. He's also a writer and musician. He blogs at raginghorse.wordpress.com. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.